Tired of not being able to get a hold of anyone when you have questions about your credit card? With 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yes, you heard that right. You can talk to a human on the Discover customer service team anytime. So the next time you have a question about your credit card, call 1-800-DISCOVER to get the service you deserve. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
You know that feeling when you walk into your home, take a deep breath, and feel new? Well, that's what it's like to use Clorox Scentiva. Because Clorox Scentiva smells like coconut, cleans like Clorox, and feels like energy. It'll elevate any cleaning routine to not just clean, but also make every room smell like a tropical coconut getaway. Discover how Clorox Scentiva's powerful clean and refreshing scents can transform your space. Get yours in coconut or other fabulous scents at a nearby retail store.
This is your moment, your time to shine, your comeback. You're ready for the next step in your career, and you want an education employers respect. So you're not just going back to school. You're coming back with Purdue Global. Backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected public universities, Purdue Global is built for people who bring their life experience into the online classroom. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Ridiculous History is a production of iHeartRadio.
Welcome back to the show, Ridiculous Historians. Thank you, as always, so much for tuning in. The energy is great here today, and we hope you are feeling a wonderful energy in your neck of the woods as well. Part of our great energy, as always, is due to the hard work and unrelenting coolness of our super producer, Mr. Max Williams. They call me Ben. Noel, we were talking off air. We were talking off air a little bit about martial arts, you, me, and Max. And you said that while you have not tried jiu-jitsu as of yet, you were, for a time, a karate kid.
Well, you know, I did study the ancient art of karate briefly. I believe I made it so far as the brown belt. No, brown belt's first. No, you white belt.
White belt?
No. Yellow belt? What order does he? Obviously, I don't know what I'm talking about.
Start off with a white belt, I think.
I know that you start out with a white belt, but then I think it's brown belt. I think it's brown belt and then maybe yellow belt.
I think purple is like, what, second to the last or something?
Yeah, purple's definitely up there. Okay, okay. I was right. It's white, orange. Yellow, orange. Okay, I did not get brown. Brown is before black. Brown is a big deal. Yeah, yeah, yellow, orange, blue, purple. Purple with a stripe. Green, green with a stripe, red, red with a stripe, brown, brown with a stripe, and black. Yeah, pretty sure I only made it so far as yellow.
And your mileage may vary, depending on who you study with. And Max, you were telling us that while you yourself are not a practitioner of jiu-jitsu, you had some close friends who were super into it.
Yeah. Actually, my dad was really into, I believe, Taekwondo, and he was a brown belt in that in his younger days. But I had two roommates at a time, and one of them wanted to become a MMA guy, so he studied a lot of jiu-jitsu and stuff. And the other guy, he studied the one that's like basically like dancing. I want to say it's capybara, but I know that's a
marsupial.
Capybara
is an adorable marsupial. Yeah, I was talking with you guys a minute ago about the episode of Bob's Burgers where Tina takes capoeira from Jaro, who has a luxurious ponytail, which he uses as a weapon while saying, ponytail, ponytail, ponytail. Jiu-jitsu is interesting, though. I mean, I think there's probably elements of this in a lot of martial arts, but, you know, the idea is to sort of weaponize your opponent's momentum. So it's a great self-defense, you know, technique for people that maybe aren't like the MMA type, you know, or like bruisers. And you can easily kind of misdirect or redirect the energy of your attacker and use it against them. So it's all about kind of movement and certain, you know, tricks that kind of will harness that momentum and actually use it to disable your opponent.
Yeah.
And like actually, you know, besting them in hand-to-hand combat per se.
Oh, it's so cool too, because the translation, if you look at what it means in English, is beautiful. So this is a Japanese martial art upon which a lot of other martial arts and combat sports have been informed. You can find elements of jiu-jitsu and so many other things. If you look at the translation, Ju, J-U, means gentle, soft, supple, flexible, or yielding. And jutsu can be kind of translated as like technique or art. So jujitsu then roughly means the yielding art. And it's exactly as you described, Noel, redirection of someone else's energy. So you might ask, if you read the title of today's episode, you might ask, what on earth does the push for voting rights have to do with jujitsu? Well, this is in part an incredibly inspiring story. Let's travel back to Britain for, you know, much of its history. Britain, like many other places in the world, only allowed certain demographics of people to vote. And they did not believe that women or female identifying individuals should be allowed to vote. So they took to the streets and they were called suffragettes, individual women fighting for voting rights for women. And if you look at, there's a great All That's Interesting article that we wanted to start off with here that describes the suffragettes thusly. It says, a lot of these British suffragettes were smaller, older women. They were, you know, wearing long dresses, big flower-covered hats, because we know hats have to be fancy at this time. And they meant to look like proper, somewhat posh, established women. But they were also, you know, they were civil activists. This is the early 1900s. They didn't want to make a violent movement, but they were confronted by, at times, brutal police forces and law enforcement. So what can they do to protect themselves against these people who are, you know, professionally trained to win fights? You know what I mean?
Yeah. And it's not like history is like done away with police brutality or, you know, kind of redirecting the narrative when it comes to dealing with protesters, you know, or like recasting them as like terrorists or, you know, agitators or what have you. We've certainly seen a lot of that recently. And you do have to protect yourself from the police, unfortunately. And this was no exception. Oftentimes, suffragettes were arrested, beaten, you know, manhandled literally by brutish, you know, men, groped. And actually, there were a few situations where during hunger strikes, they were like forcibly fed through rubber tubes, which is just about the most invasive, awful thing I can imagine. Black Friday was a very, very dark day for the suffragette movement. November 8th, 1910, two marchers were actually killed by police. And this led to basically what we've been describing leading up to a need to have a way of defending yourself while also protecting yourself from prosecution by, let's say, handling illegal weapons, you know, for example. I believe, you know, Britain has always largely been a gun-free society. Even the police just use, like, clubs and truncheons or whatever to beat people up. But at the very least, you don't see a lot of police shootings. But that doesn't mean you can't kill somebody by beating them too hard, because that's what we saw with those deaths on Black Friday. Enter a very important figure in the suffragette movement, a slight middle-aged woman, kind of perfectly fit the bill of that classic suffragette kind of look, a woman named Edith Margaret Giroud, who is described in that All Things Interesting article as being tiny yet tenacious. And she was the person who brought jiu-jitsu to the women of the suffrage movement.
Yes, yes, she is the protagonist of our story today. Edith was born in Bath, Somerset in 1872, and she didn't have an easy start at life, quite candidly. Her parents were unmarried, and that was a big, big no-no at the time in that society. So she was sent away to live with her aunt. She didn't really fit in with any cliques at school and didn't feel like she belonged. So she found refuge in the world of athletics and pursued that as a hobby. Fast forward to 1893. She has become a teacher at a school where she helps the kids learn physical education, and she meets this guy named William. She marries William, and then in 1899, the Girard couple sees a demonstration by this guy named Edward Barton Wright. Now, usually when we hear the word demonstration here in modern day society, we think of something like a protest. There was a demonstration for or against a given social issue. But back in the day, in this period of time, a demonstration would be much more like a show, like come see this amazing, you know, like toe
like an
slapper.
Like an expo. Yeah, exactly. 100%.
And this guy went on stage, Edward Barton Wright, and he said, I have developed my own proprietary style of grappling and then striking. I call it, in a burst of humility,
grapple strike.
Well, he called it Bartitsu, because he's Barton Wright. Yeah, Ed.
Okay, I'll take it. Yeah. Grapple strike's a strong second, though, I would argue.
Well, yeah, I would say, honestly, it's always questionable when somebody names something after themselves. So anyway, people were into this idea. They watched these demonstrations. Folks knew about Edward Barton Wright, and his style became so well known that Sherlock Holmes actually mentions it in a 1903 story by Arthur Conan Doyle. So it was in the zeitgeist, you could say.
Mm-hmm. It's kind of funny, though, if you think about it. I mean, this dude, like you said, naming something after yourself is usually a good sign of some mild form of megalomania. But it's also like, you know, this was a form of jiu-jitsu that he was demonstrating, and he basically culturally appropriated it and named it after himself.
Yes. Yeah. And the Garrards, we know from this point, were very interested in this concept. One of the most poetic and beautiful things about martial arts is the idea that we described earlier, which is there's a hip hop song that puts it perfectly by Dead Prez. It's the idea that a poor man's empty hand is a weapon. And the Garrards were fascinated. They went on to study with a Japanese jiu-jitsu instructor who knew Barton Wright. His name, Sadakozu Uyenishi. And when Uyenishi left in 1908, they actually took over his dojo. Edith would teach the women and children's classes. And one of the things that she always emphasized to these populations or to her students was, hey, look, you don't have to be bigger than your foe or your opponent. As a matter of fact, you can use the leverage of jiu-jitsu to overpower them. And people found this tremendously inspiring. I want to shout out Jake Rawson, wrote an excellent Mental Floss article on this.
Great title, too. The Female Jiu-Jitsu Crew That Defended Women's Rights. I say that in, like, you know, kung fu movie dub voice.
Oh, there it is. Yeah, yeah.
This is great, though. I mean, like, you know, remember the children's classes. I mean, this was dangerous time, you know. There were pickpockets and thieves and, you know, rippers around every corner, you know, and you had to be able to defend yourself against all those rippers, you know, and if you're a kid, the best way to be able to do that, kid or a smallish person, you know, or someone that's not maybe as powerful, jiu-jitsu is perfect. It really does, you know, kind of use your opponent's weaknesses against them. So, you know, the Girouds obviously they wanted to go deep with this. Obviously, Barton Wright was their kind of inroad into the deeper study of true Japanese jiu-jitsu. Baritsu wasn't enough for them. They wanted to go all the way. So like you said, they actually took over that jiu-jitsu dojo from Uyenishi there in Golden Square in London, and they made a big go of it, and it was very successful. So Garrard achieved some further notoriety when she released a short film in 1907, which would have been, you know, no small feat. It was not exactly the most democratized technology at the time. It would have been something you would have had to pay a pretty penny to do. And, you know, it made the rounds, and it was a film as opposed to, like, you know, one of those expos we talked about. It was a film, obviously able to be much more widely distributed, that showed off her technique, you know, and how she could take down a much larger opponent. and a very important figurehead and leader of the women's suffrage movement, Emmeline Pankhurst, invited her to appear at the Women's Social and Political Union meeting in 1909. And she made a real impact on the suffragettes. They were just so impressed with her poise and her passion about this technique, and they wanted to be a part of it. They asked if she would do regular training sessions for the suffragettes. By December of that year, Jared had an exclusive contract, almost essentially, with the suffragettes, and started something called Suffragette Self-Defense Club. And this was exactly what it sounded like. It was just a way of kind of teaching these women to defend themselves using the techniques of jiu-jitsu.
Snagajob is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snagajob is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position: warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snagajob's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text SNAG to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
This episode is brought to you by eBay Motors. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Noel, do you remember your favorite car?
Well, yeah. It was an Eddie Bauer edition Ford Explorer.
Oh, that's and cool.
I just remember it was my dad's. I was a hand-me-down car kind of kid. Dad would buy a new car. I'd get that car. And I just remember feeling so awesome being up above everybody, like I was in Mad Max or something, you know?
I had a lot of land yachts that I loved. I had Pontiac Bonnevilles.
Right.
Oh, I never had an El Camino. My dad had one, and that was a real interesting use of our collective time, keeping that thing running. But I think these cars all kind of speak to us because they were such a fundamental part of our lives. Do you remember when I had that Monte Carlo?
That's what I meant. I said El Camino, and I meant Monte Carlo.
I miss it so. The Monte Carlo was tough. I owned a series of Monte Carlos, and the last one, God bless it, I had to learn a lot about car maintenance just to keep that guy running.
Totally.
But it still was like a perfect fit. It's almost like finding your true love. You know, like when you recently got a car a few years back now.
Oh, man. And funny you should say that. That particular perfect fit was the Honda Fit, which I love dearly. But, Ben, it's getting a little long in the tooth. And while it's been incredibly reliable up to now, it's getting to that age where I might have to start looking for some parts here and there to keep it running.
Mm-hmm. And that's where eBay Motors comes in. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly.
Brake kits, LED headlights, roof racks, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it.
And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back.
Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash.
So keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com.
Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Whether you're a savvy spender maximizing your savings with cashback rewards, a thrifty rate watcher seeking the lowest interest, or a travel enthusiast looking for extraordinary perks, Kemba Financial Credit Union has a Visa to complement your lifestyle and unique needs. Apply today at Kemba.org to unlock a limited-time 2% cashback on purchases and pay 0% interest on balance transfers for an entire year with a new Visa from Kemba. You deserve a card that works for you. Restrictions apply. Offer ends June 30th, 2024.
And this escalated in step with the push against equal voting rights. So Edith started holding self-defense classes for suffragettes, essentially saying, here's what happens if you have to deal with hecklers at a protest, specifically at a dance school nearby. When those protests at this dance school on Argyll Street began to run into increasingly violent opposition, not just from regular jerk civilian dudes, but from the actual police, she said, okay, self-defense is all well and good, but now I am going to teach you how to fight back. And a lot of this information comes from Jared's great nephew, Martin Williams. Martin says that Edith would sometimes use the former dojo as a hiding place for her fellow activists. She didn't want people to know Golden Square was a dojo. And she was very, for anybody who's unfamiliar with the layout of the area at the time, this was in the nice part of town. So she was happy that the dojo was in Golden Square because people were less likely to suspect something wasn't on the up and up. In 2012, Martin tells the Islington Tribune, quote, the suffragettes would create a disturbance in Oxford Street, but then they'd run back to the dojo and hide their clubs and bats under the floor. By the time the cops arrived, they'd be pretending they were in the middle of their exercise class. So imagine you're the police force. You're trying to track down some what you're told is like a mob of,
rabble-rousers in here.
Yeah. And then, no, just us, officer, just getting in our movements. Now, one and two and one.
Doing our calisthenics.
Can I help you? We are in the middle of a course. Yeah, this worked.
We're not so used to gentlemen callers in our gymnasium. Yes.
So by 1910, think about how quickly this is happening. By 1910, she is constantly conducting classes exclusively for the suffragette movement. And as publicity, a demonstration, she had an open call for any curious men to challenge her. And all she asked is, she said, show up anytime. You know what I mean? Get at me. All I ask is that you put on a police hat before I wax you in front of my students. And she
give me something to focus my rage towards. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And she even talks about this. Like, she went on to talk about this for many years. In 1965, she relayed this anecdote where a policeman had said, now then, move on. You can't stop causing an obstruction here. And then she said, excuse me, it's you who are making an obstruction. And then she shoulder flipped him.
Yeah. And
introduced him to the ground.
Yeah. And let's not forget, too, I don't know if we really hit this home, but they're not like wearing geese or something. Like, they're wearing their petticoats. And oftentimes they would use those big ruffles and those, very wide hoop skirts to hide weapons underneath. So they could quickly stick them down there and make a run for it and be completely incognito. Really, really cool. I love that. Just excuse me, sir. It is you who is making an obstruction. Skadoom.
Yeah.
To the floor. It's like, it's such a badass, give me back my son or something. You know what I mean? Like, that's like, that would be the line from the movie trailer, before the name of the movie. It'd be called Suffragettes.
Right. Suffragettes. Yeah, and then maybe we do that cool late 80s, early 90s thing where you see two different fonts. So it's Suffragettes hits the screen. And then in cursive or crazy writing, it says Jujitsu.
Exactly. Or as it was actually coined at the time, I believe it was Suffrage Jujitsu because it became
Suffragettes.
Suffragettes. It became, and I don't know if it was meant to be sometimes when the press or whomever coined little phrases like that, they do it with sort of like a eye roll or like a sort of flippant attitude, but it's pretty cool. Exactly. It'd be suffered, and that would be in the fancy calligraphy font, and then jitsu would be in blood red, Japanese kind of like calligraphy strokes.
Love it.
You're welcome. We're going to make this movie.
Yeah. That's not arrogant to say. So there's something else that happens that's really important with the role of jujitsu and how the public perceived it in Britain at the time. So as we discussed, it means like the art of yielding, roughly. It's redirecting energy. When it first hit Britain in 1898, people considered it, quote, suitable for women because they thought it was somewhat elegant and feminine. It wasn't about overpowering people with force. You read the room of where your opponent's moving, and then you just kind of help them get where they're going.
All right, ladies, you can do two things. You can go forage for seaweed at the shore, or you can learn the art of yielding.
Just don't be playing
even
at
yielding.
It.
Yeah, because even, I mean, isn't that funny? It required that kind of like, it's such a like pernicious thing, and in a good way. Like, same with the seaweed. You know, it was sort of like seaweed was science that was okay for women too. But it was really, you know, still very interesting work. And it was something that they could really like, you know, chew on in terms of like being creative, in terms of like doing, discovering nature and all that stuff. This is the same. And this is like, you know, you look at it not reading too far into it, you know, as a dumb man, and you're like, oh yeah, it's the art of yielding. Like, it's about like, it's graceful movements, you know, it's basically like jazzercise, but it actually is a way to take down a man, you know, to take down a police force if you have enough women that are armed with these techniques.
Yeah. And Tony Wolf, who is one of the world-class experts on older martial arts, had a really interesting meta-analysis of this. He said that the tactics used by the protesters, even when they weren't physically practicing jujitsu, they were still sort of philosophically practicing some of the precepts of that art, because they were a radical movement. They were relatively small in their numbers. They had to rely on skill, on leverage, and at times on trickery or deception. They wouldn't have expected that women could respond physically to violent action, let alone put up an effective resistance. That line is from Martin Dixon, who's chairman of the British Jiu-Jitsu Association. So it was an ideal way for them to handle someone who's grabbing them and expecting them to instantly just freeze up or wilt or comply. Let me introduce you to my good friend, the floor.
I like the point you make about the philosophical aspects of jiu-jitsu. You know, you often hear the term like mental jiu-jitsu thrown around. It's sort of a way of, you know, playing chess with an opponent, you know, of like kind of outsmarting somebody or using their own ideology against them or using their words against them. This was a war of minds just as much as it was a war of, you know, fists in the streets, I guess, right? So this, you know, tradition really could have added a layer of craftiness, you know, to the types of, you know, plays that these women were making, and could have really helped them in that aspect of it as well.
Mm-hmm. Now, it may sound wild, fellow ridiculous historians, to think that once upon a time, the idea of everybody having the right to vote would seem so controversial that state powers would attempt to violently suppress that concept. And the reason it seems so crazy is because a great many very, very brave, very intelligent, dare I say, very noble people fought for this human right. And I, you know, I've been in protest in a number of different countries, and the ones that are often really successful without turning into riots and so on are ones where the protesters know a couple of things that our suffragettes in today's episode were well aware of. Property damage can get you headlines, right? Property damage gets you into the paper and the conversation, but you need to win hearts and minds of the neutral observer, which means you don't want to look like the bad guys. You don't want to look like the baddies, as they would say. The suffragettes said, okay, we're not going to actually hurt anybody. We're not going to damage a factory or other workplace such that people are going to lose their jobs. For instance, one time Edith was with a gathering of women there on Oxford Street, and they coordinated this. She blew a whistle, and when she did, everybody pulled hammers and rocks from beneath their clothes. Like you mentioned, Noel, those big clothes served a purpose. And then they threw them through shop windows. This was seen as a justified action for protesting, and it wasn't seen as like empty vandalism. She defended it pretty well, but if you go over to a great article on a website I had just found, I don't know about you guys, but it's called badreputation.org.uk. Mm. Yeah, it's great. I highly recommend
it. I love that URL.
Yeah, yeah. It's there was one article there from 2011 by Stephen B., which talks about this protest. You know, we know any protest is going to be somewhat controversial on some level. That's why it's a protest. People are protesting a thing. But there were other acts too. You know, there was a different group that was considered more radical. They set mailboxes on fire. They threw flower bombs at the prime minister. If shopkeepers refused to support suffrage, they would smash windows. And then you didn't see this guy coming in the story, I bet. But here's our unexpected cameo. Mahatma Gandhi shows up, played, of course, by Sir Ben Kingsley in our movie.
Hearts and Minds.
Yes.
for all time. I gotta, you know, I think you and I both are probably big fans of like classic fighting games, like side-scrolling fighting games, like Street Fighter. Mortal Kombat and all that. Wouldn't it be cool if there was one made up entirely of historical figures and Mahatma Gandhi in particular was like rocking some serious jiu-jitsu?
That's perfect. Yeah, there was one game that had deities fighting in a Street Fighter. I'll send it to you off air if I can find it. But yeah, Noel, that's a brilliant idea. I am 100% on board. Here's what the real non-fighting Gandhi said. Because, you know, Gandhi in a fighting game is interesting because he's really famous for not fighting. Anyway, Gandhi says, look, in 1909, he tells an assembly of British suffragettes, your cause is correct. Your cause is just, but your tactics are unacceptable. And he was very like, I'm not mad. I'm disappointed. Kind of tutting and shaking his head. But the police, their response to this was to crack down. And we see this often in response to protest, right? The struggle becomes increasingly acrimonious in the years leading up to World War I. Women are arrested when they go on hunger strike. Like you said, Noel, they were force-fed. And when they're out on marches, they're getting manhandled, they're getting knocked to the ground. And then we get to an event on the 18th of November, 1910, known as Black Friday.
Yes, Black Friday, what we alluded to early on in the episode, wherein a group of around 300 suffragettes were essentially bum-rushed by a phalanx of police officers outside Parliament. They were, in fact, entirely outnumbered. And they were essentially just beaten by the police and
random dudes.
Just add insult to injury. Yeah, random dudes, insult to injury, you know, as if they didn't have it covered with just the bobbies with, you know, bludgeons. They had these bros coming in to swing their clubs and fists as well. Really, really gross. Absolute targeting of a peaceful protest. And no wonder they decided they wanted to be able to you know, fight back. Some serious injuries. We talked about two deaths, more than 100 arrests. And Elizabeth Crawford, who wrote the Women's Suffrage Movement, A Reference Guide, had this to say. A lot said they had been groped by the police and male bystanders. After that, women didn't go to these demonstrations unprepared. So again, it's not like they just wanted to fight. Like you said from the top, Ben, this was not an inherently violent movement. It was a peaceful protest, based movement. It wasn't until they were pushed and pushed and pushed they decided they needed to push back. It's been a while since I've seen it, but if I remember correctly, I believe the mom in Mary Poppins is a suffragist.
Yes, yes,
and
she is.
And is like having like suffrage, women's suffrage meetings in their home. And they'd all definitely appear in this kind of dress that we're talking about. So probably a little bit of an idealized version of this, but it definitely is around the time that we're talking about, where Mary Poppins and, you know, cartoon penguins were just all over the place.
I loved it. For a time, I wanted to be a chimney sweep. And Mary Poppins, as at least in the film adaptation, makes a great point about the evils of banking. So anyhow,
I'm glad that you chose a different course for your life's trajectory, Ben, because turns out it's not nearly as cheery and dancey as one might think.
Check out our earlier episode. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah, oh, it was often like children too. They like suffocated in chimneys when they got stuck.
Which they, I think, is in the Criterion version of Mary Poppins.
Exactly.
Let us know. So this tragedy ends up with, as you said, people dead and a lot of people imprisoned. You see, Garrett, climbing atop the prison walls, trying to boost morale. She's singing, she's waving flags. And when people are freed, they go to her and she teaches them how to do basic throws on aggressive policemen, and then also how to avoid bludgeon injuries by wrapping cotton and cardboard around your ribs, sort of a MacGyver kind of armor or body protection. And the suffragettes appreciate Garrett. They see in Edith a tremendous gift, a secret weapon.
You know, and they were very protective of her too. They didn't want to risk her, you know, their secret weapon being arrested or, you know, separated from them. So oftentimes, you know, she would be back at the dojo and that would be sort of a home base. And she always was able to kind of like carry out these sort of subterfuges when the cops came looking for the women, you know, who smashed all the shop windows. They'd come running back and, you know, she would like stash their street clothes in those secret compartments we talked about earlier.
We're just doing all movements, officer.
Yes.
And the escalation just continued, though, because it became clear that the suffragette forces knew they had a righteous cause and they were not going to be intimidated. They were not going to fold. And so authorities kicked things up another terrible notch and they passed a law that was officially known as the Prisoner's Temporary Discharge for Ill Health Act of 1913. Its street name, the Cat and Mouse Act. It was part of an intense information propaganda war between feminist forces and law enforcement. You know, I'm going to say team feminist here because they had things that aren't particularly hot takes. They said force feeding us is an act of torture, and the government is responding by releasing protesters who were on hunger strike while imprisoned just long enough for them to get a little bit healthier, and then they track them back down, rearrest them, re-imprison them. So they let you go out to eat, and then they arrest you
again. Catch and release is what they call it, and then catch again. And it was probably a way to keep eyes on them as well, right? If you release them and then you like surveil them, then you get intel into what's going on with the movement if you play your cards right.
Exactly. And we should mention, while we've spent a lot of time focusing on Edith, she's working in concert with the organizer of the United Kingdom's suffragette movement, Emmeline Pankhurst. And Emmeline Pankhurst is repeatedly captured. She's repeatedly harassed. She's leading a lot of these protests that law enforcement objects to. Eventually, people active in the movement realize that Pankhurst cannot be captured again. She is too important, and law enforcement also knows she's important. So she might spend years just being moved from one jail cell to the next, which is tough for me to say with a Tennessee accent. Jail cell. Okay, got there.
So rural juror.
Oh, yeah.
That's tough.
Yeah.
This is so neat because they, you know, they take it to the next level. They organize essentially like a group, an elite squad of suffragettes that they refer to as the bodyguard, which I love that. It's like, you know, it's not just one bodyguard. They're almost like an army, but they're called the bodyguard, starring Whitney Houston and Kevin Costner.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I want to just jump in here real quick about like Pankhurst. It should also be pointed out that she's in her like mid-50s by this point.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
Yes.
So they're like, okay, we got to definitely protect her. We don't want her just being, you know, everything that
she represents so much, you know, like just symbolically. It's important to have her for the women of the movement to rally behind. The media, once again, doing some kind of tongue-in-cheek, eye-rolly kind of nicknaming, referred to them not as the bodyguard, but as the Amazons, which is, you know, a little problematic.
A bit, yeah, maybe a bit. No, it is very much a bit problematic. So their mission, the bodyguard, saw their mission as keeping Pankhurst's prison breaks as long as possible. These were also people who were in very good shape. They were willing to risk their own freedom and their own personal safety and health. They were almost always single because it was considered unfair for mothers to be thrown in jail. These were not just the most physically active folks. They also had the most advanced knowledge of jujitsu in a network of secret locations. How cool is that? They also came from the ranks of the most radical suffragettes. They used code names. They used like disguises and stuff. They hid bowling pin shaped clubs, flower pots, and other weapons in their dresses. They made that armor I talked about earlier with cardboard and cotton padding. And they were prepared at any time. They were just always on call. And sometimes all they would get is a ring that says, hey, there's a car that looks like this. You need to follow it. Get on it. And, you know, they would put the stuff, strap on the cardboard, the cotton, and they're off to the races. And hopefully one day the aim is to be off to the ballot box as well. So they were fighting again for a good reason. And eventually they became even more organized. They were not backing down in front of the police. The police were aware of this and they tried to spy on Garrod's jujitsu lessons from the skylights of the dojo. So picture
grapes.
Yeah, I'm right. The Peeping Tom squad. So in our film here, picture some kind of bumbling Keystone Cop-esque figures just maybe slipping and falling off the skylight. Or a Wilhelm scream, maybe, Max. Yes, exactly. So
that was my impression of the Wilhelm scream.
It's a tough one. It's tough to do that one. So let's go to February 1914. It's just a month before another big event that we'll get to in a second called the Battle of Glasgow. The bodyguard, aka the Amazons, had another tough pickle in front of them. Pankhurst is delivering a barnstorming speech off this balcony at someone's house in Camden Square. She is wearing a veil and she has members of the bodyguard at her side on the balcony. And the police are down below, like, because they're thinking as soon as she's done, we're going to rearrest her. And then she said, I am coming down and I dare you to stop me.
Come at me, bro, yet again. But they pulled kind of probably one of the only memorable or useful things from The Phantom Menace was the body double for Natalie Portman's character, which I believe was, did we talk about this the other day? Was it us?
We did.
Keira Knightley and Natalie Portman, two different people. You heard
two different people,
first.
But used to great effect in that body double scenario in the movie.
I like Phantom Menace. Did
I mean, it's, you know.
That makes one of us.
It's not a good movie.
That's fine. Nostalgia
is a hell of a drug. I will say that.
I was in like fifth grade when it came out. So.
You can like something and not think it's good. You know what
I mean? I agree.
I think that's what most people say about this podcast.
But I mean, Jar Jar Binks has not aged well, to say the least. Let's just say that.
Did you hear the theory that Lucas wanted him to be a Sith Lord? Anyway, this doesn't matter. But look it up on your own when you have time.
Maybe he'd be a little more reserved as a Sith Lord. I don't think he'd be like babbling incoherently in a vaguely patois accent.
Watch the video on the Jar Jar Binks thing and let me know. You're right about the body double. Decoy.
They pulled a Phantom Menace. They pulled an Amidala switcheroo here. And there was another woman wearing a veil that they sent down instead. Right?
Yeah, exactly. Brilliant plan, and it worked. But now we have to go to the Battle of Glasgow.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire. With the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snagajob is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position. Warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snagajob's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly.
So visit snagajob.com or text snag to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
This episode is brought to you by eBay Motors. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Noel, do you remember your favorite car?
Well, yeah. It was a an Eddie Bauer edition Ford Explorer.
Oh, that's and cool.
I just remember it was my dad's. I was a hand-me-down car kind of kid. Dad would buy a new car. I'd get that car. And I just remember feeling so awesome being up above everybody, like I was in Mad Max or something, you know?
I had a lot of land yachts that I loved. I had Pontiac, Bonnevilles.
Right.
Oh, I never had an El Camino. My dad had one. And that was a real interesting use of our collective time, keeping that thing running. But I think these cars all kind of speak to us because they were such a fundamental part of our lives. Do you remember when I had that Monte Carlo?
That's what I meant. I said El Camino and I meant Monte Carlo.
I miss it. So the Monte Carlo was tough. I had a series of Monte Carlos, and the last one, God bless it, I had to learn a lot about car maintenance just to keep that guy running.
Totally.
But it still was like a perfect fit. It's almost like finding your true love. You know, like when you recently got a car a few years back now.
Oh, man. And funny you should say that. That particular perfect fit was the Honda Fit, which I love dearly. But, Ben, it's getting a little long in the tooth. And while it's been incredibly reliable up to now, it's getting to that age where I might have to start looking for some parts here and there to keep it running.
Mm-hmm. And that's where eBay Motors comes in. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly.
Brake kits, LED headlights, roof racks, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it.
And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back.
Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash.
So keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com.
Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Whether you're a savvy spender maximizing your savings with cashback rewards, a thrifty rate watcher seeking the lowest interest, or a travel enthusiast looking for extraordinary perks, Kemba Financial Credit Union has a Visa to complement your lifestyle and unique needs. Apply today at Kemba.org to unlock a limited-time 2% cashback on purchases and pay 0% interest on balance transfers for an entire year with a new Visa from Kemba. You deserve a card that works for you. Restrictions apply. Offer ends June 30th, 2024.
So tension has continued and continued and ratcheted up, and things are reaching even more of a breaking point. So there's this assembly hall in Glasgow, Scotland, and on March 1914, local police officers swarm the area to arrest Pankhurst. Again, she's one of the loudest voices in this movement, and she had traveled from London to rally support. Again, the stuff she's asking for does not sound like any kind of hot take at all. It sounds like basic human rights for people. She says, you know what? Women should be able to vote. They should be able to get divorced if they want to, and they should be able to inherit land. These are all things the dudes can already do. So why not? She also anticipated a fight. She anticipated the man coming down hard. So she arrived with the bodyguard. The bodyguard at this time is about 25 individuals. They were trained in jiu-jitsu, club fighting, sabotage by Edith. They weren't preparing for hypothetical threats. You know, as we said, they had been beaten and assaulted by police before. The police already had a grudge with her now, by the time she gets to Scotland, because she made them look really dumb when the body double thing worked. So she also made them look dumb in Scotland, because when she shows up to her own rally, she just buys a ticket and walks in. Do they not know what she looks like? Like, imagine, Ye, waiting in line for his own concert and just having to pay the $25 or whatever. I don't know how much.
It's a thing you run into a lot in like period pieces or like, you know, kind of costume mystery type dramas. There often is like a lack of like awareness by the authorities as to what somebody looks like. You know what I mean? Like, I think, you know, maybe it was just a matter of like, it was I mean, there was photography, of course, but it wasn't very sharp, you know, I guess. And it was almost more like an artist rendering. So it does seem like it may have been more common for folks to not know exactly what someone looked like.
Yeah, no, that's a very good point, man. And it works to Pankhurst's advantage at this juncture. So she comes up and they go, oh my God, who let her in or whatever? And the police are a mob. They outnumber the bodyguards. Like think of, we said 25 bodyguards, think of like 50 plus police officers. But according to this story, Pankhurst gets about 30 words out before someone reacts to the police encroachment. A suffragette takes out a pistol, takes aim, and fires. They fire blanks, but it stuns the officer. They didn't know, you know, they like, who thought this would turn into a gunfight? Other officers get tossed. Just picture them to and fro. Fa-boom, fa-boom, fa-boom. Welcome to the floor. Welcome to the floor. May I introduce you?
Not only welcome to the floor, welcome to these like razor wire filled flower bouquets that were everywhere. And they were throwing the cops like straight into those things. So they were getting like all sliced up. Serious, like, you know, they're really taking it to the next level at this point in terms of their planning, in terms of their, you know, just their willingness to kind of do whatever it took. The suffragettes, I mean. Like, so they had these like, you know, razor wire laced flower bouquets that they were using to their advantage, and the cops were completely unaware of.
Yeah. Now picture this as the climactic scene, right? Toward the beginning of our third act in our film. There is an all-out brawl. Like Vince McMahon would be envious of the spectacle that occurs here. And it's very dangerous because it's real. They are taking out these clubs. And when we say clubs, they were called Indian clubs at the time. Picture a bowling pin. Back then, they were used a lot in exercise classes, right? And now they become a weapon. So the suffragettes have their bowling pins out. The police didn't expect to be met with a bunch of martial artists who by this time were quite skilled. So they pull out their clubs, the police pull out their batons and their truncheons, and then they go at it. And also the bodyguard, like you said, Noel, they catch people in barbed wire. Then this brawl happens in front of 4,000 folks before Pankhurst finally gets moved away. Epic.
Totally epic. I mean, yeah, nothing quite like it in history, as far as I'm aware, in terms of like this very gendered clash in the streets, you know, with what many in those days might have called the fairer sex getting the upper hand in a very big way.
And that was one of the climactic battles of the suffrage movement in the United Kingdom. But there was another battle. It was bigger than the local police, and it was bigger than the United Kingdom itself, and it was on the horizon. It was the outbreak of what we call World War I today. Back then, of course, they just called it, you know, the Great War or World War. Horrific, horrific thing. The suffragette forces concentrated on helping the war effort. In fact, Emmeline Pankhurst, according again to a couple of different citations, she essentially decided that, hey, women's rights aren't going to be of much use to us if Germany occupies Great Britain. So we need to keep the country we want to vote in free. That was her calculus. And then as the world descended into pandemonium and chaos, the bodyguard, whom the press called the Amazons, and Edith Garrett were almost entirely forgotten.
Almost, but not entirely. But yeah, I was very, very much unaware of this period, or at least the specifics. And certainly with the badass, you know, hand-to-hand combat angle. I mean, this is really, really fascinating. But of course, as we know, there is a happy ending. This is a movement that results in, over time, the goal that they set out to achieve. And at the end of the war in 1918, there was a renewed kind of interest in the suffrage movement. But the attitude had changed to a degree in terms of like the the government's approach to, you know, the suffrage movement. And so there wasn't quite the same need to, you know, be militaristic in the same way as it had been before. And pretty quickly after the war, around 8 million women got the right to vote, thanks to an act called the Representation of the People Act. By 1928, everyone else in Britain was also granted the right to vote. I'm not quite sure what the distinction was with the 8 million women that were given the right so quickly and why it took 10 more years. Yeah, let's hear Max with the facts on this one.
I was looking on Wikipedia, reading it. It was like in 1928 is when they extended it to all women age 21 or older were able to vote. So it might have been something similar to, like, you know, early on in America, like if you owned land, you could vote.
Right.
So that it might have just been like that 8 million was just a subsect of women. It wasn't until 28 that everyone.
Yeah, because this
right that everyone had.
Yeah. For the first 10 years, the People Act required voters, female voters specifically, to own property. But it did not require men to own property. It gave the right to vote to all men, regardless of race or class. And then it wasn't until the Representation of the People Act 1928 that property requirements for women were done away with. So that was the big thing. And so we're going to let poor people vote too, now that we had 10 years to get a running start. So it's a hard won victory. Yeah,
it is a hard won victory and a hard fought victory. I mean, super, super interesting. Another example of just like stick-to-itiveness and resolve, you know, ultimately ending up getting, you know, getting the right result.
Heroes.
Yeah, 1,000,000%. And man, earlier I was sort of making the joke, or you and I were both sort of like spitballing what this movie would be. And I think I said suffragette and then jiu-jitsu or suffra-jiu-jitsu. But yeah, in 2015, there is a movie called Suffragette. And it's the first time that the suffragist movement has really been highlighted in mainstream popular culture. Although I will say, I think that some of these accounts are forgetting about that scene in Mary Poppins. Not that it's like the central focus of the movie, obviously, but they do address it and you see them carrying their signs and stuff. But this is an entire film. And also, I believe there's a graphic novel trilogy.
Yes, mm-hmm. I've read this one. Suffragette. Yeah, it's cool. It's a trio, or it's a trilogy rather. So check that out. I should be recommending more graphic novels. But I know we're going a little bit long on this one, but we hope you found this story as exciting, as inspiring, and as compelling as the three of us did. You will be happy to know that Edith continued to run the dojo well until she retired in 1925. She lived to the ripe old age of 99, and she even in her last year of life gave one final interview where she talked about this period, and the picture in the interview is her locking the journalist down, getting him in a wrist lock or a wrist hold. One thing this shows us is, you guys, we got to start going to the gym. I think that's a secret to longevity. We got to start going back to the gym, because I sure use the pandemic as an excuse.
Yeah, I've been slacking off the last couple of weeks, but I did get a Planet Fitness membership. And you know what? I'm going to go today and I'm going to do a little circuit training in honor of Edith. Yeah, there's a really great like photo kind of set in Health and Strength magazine, I think, where she's just giving the beat down to somebody. It's almost cartoonish, you know, as you would say, Ben. I believe she wrote a play that this was highlighting, and it was called Jiu-Jitsu as a Husband Tamer. It's pretty fantastic.
Yep. And you want to see that photo series, just Google What Every Woman Ought to Know and put Edith Garrett's name in there. You will see the pictures. We hope you enjoy them. So we thought about making this a two-parter because we knew it was going to run a little long, but it feels like just one cohesive audio film to us. And we do hope you agree. Thanks, as always, so much to Mr. Max Williams, the man, the myth, the legend. Thank you to the hardworking and incredibly courageous people of years gone by who have won these invaluable human rights for people across the world today. And then You know, just because I like him having a hard act to follow and all, thanks to Jonathan Strickland. You know, so.
Always. Yeah. I'm really starting to warm back up to that guy. You know, he's sort of like a, he's sort of like that, the mosquito bite, you know, where it's sort of annoying, but then when you scratch it, it feels so good, you know? That's what Strickland is
I've
like.
I've never scratched him, but I'll take your word for it.
Oh, it feels good. But definite thanks to you. Like we said last episode, I think we're going to try to get him on more of like a predictable cadence, as they might say.
For our own mental health.
In the podcast biz. For our own mental health. Because, man, when he just pops up out of nowhere, I feel like I'm about to have a panic attack or like some sort of, you know, brain fugue.
PTSD, dude. I saw him on the street one time and I was like, don't ask me questions. And thanks to you, Noel, this is one of the ones I really enjoy. You know, this is a story I think more people should know, and I'm just tremendously grateful that the three of us are able to do this every week.
Same. We'll see you next time, folks. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
You know that feeling when you walk into your home, take a deep breath, and feel new? Well, that's what it's like to use Clorox Scentiva. Because Clorox Scentiva smells like coconut, cleans like Clorox, and feels like energy. It'll elevate any cleaning routine to not just clean, but also make every room smell like a tropical coconut getaway. Discover how Clorox Scentiva's powerful clean and refreshing scents can transform your space. Get yours in coconut or other fabulous scents at a nearby retail store.
Whether you're a savvy spender maximizing your savings with cashback rewards, a thrifty rate watcher seeking the lowest interest, or a travel enthusiast looking for extraordinary perks, Kemba Financial Credit Union has a Visa to complement your lifestyle and unique needs. Apply today at Kemba.org to unlock a limited-time 2% cashback on purchases and pay 0% interest on balance transfers for an entire year with a new Visa from Kemba. You deserve a card that works for you. Restrictions apply. Offer ends June 30th, 2024.
There's nothing worse than wearing clothes that don't fit right. That's why Tomboy X makes size and gender inclusive underwear, swimwear, and loungewear for all bodies. Queer founded and run for over 10 years, you can trust they know a thing or two about making the perfect pair. Feel comfortable in your own skin. Shop online today and use code IHEART for 20% off your first purchase. Only at TomboyX.com. Tomboy X. Fit for you just as you are.